Good morning.
Good morning.
As promised, so today's shiur and the next couple of shiurim will be an attempt to examine, to explore together with you the halachic decision-making process, the way that I'm given to understand it from learning it from my rebbeim. And in order to do that, what I've picked was one sugya, one not a halachic question that I'm going to be searching for the answer to, but rather a topic which hopefully when studied properly will yield the answer to a number of different questions. And even before we begin, it's important to note that most topics don't lend themselves to presenting the full breadth of the research that's necessary to arrive at a halachic conclusion in a small series of a couple of shiurim. Most topics relate probably to tens of different, you know, places in the Gemara, in which case you would have to see the Gemaras on those subjects and the Rishonim who comment on those Gemaras and the Poskim, the Rambams, the Shulchan Aruch, the Poskim who comment on the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. Usually there would be a whole range, many, many Sifrei Shilos to Tshuvos to look through. Hello. And hence they don't lend themselves easily to presenting all of the material that a person needs within even a manageable number of shiurim. However, there are certain sugyos that are small enough to be shared in a context such as this, and it's through those sugyos particularly that one can gain an insight into what type of research and what type of analysis goes into the larger sugyos as well. Just we'll imagine, whenever we're completed with this particular sugya, we can imagine doing this just on a scale 10 or 100 times as grand. And so, I want to begin. Basically, this sugya is based on a Mishnah in Maseches Megillah. And I first want to say that I taught this Mishnah to some students in Yeshiva University's high school over this past year, and I'm indebted to them for their input into the structure of this shiur. And as well, I learned the sugya with one of my chavrusot, Avraham Rachamim, and I want to thank him as well for the input that he gave, which helped structure this shiur in what I hope is the most interesting and understandable and accessible manner. So without further ado, let's plunge into the sugya. The first source here is a Mishnah, Maseches Megillah, and the Mishnah is talking about somebody called a pocheach. Pei, vav, ches, ches, a pocheach. Now in modern Hebrew, what does pocheach mean?
Pachach is a blacksmith.
No, pachach is a blacksmith, but this is pocheach. Which is
the son of a blacksmith.
No.
A
scoundrel, if you want. That's the closest word that I can find.
Okay, so in modern Hebrew, a pocheach means a scoundrel, right? But in Mishnaic Hebrew, that's not necessarily what it means. Right? That's part of from a different shear.
Yes.
In the Torah, the word tzav, right, means something. Right, and in the Mishnah, the word tzav might mean something else. Anyhow, so there's differences between Biblical Hebrew, Mishnaic Hebrew, and modern Hebrew, and we cannot necessarily jump to a conclusion on the basis of modern Hebrew as to the meaning of the word pocheach in Mishnaic Hebrew.
Say it in Yiddish. People who didn't understand.
And so we're going to have to basically, the sugya is going to center around investigating and trying to figure out what is the meaning of the word pocheach. We'll probably encounter 7 different possible interpretations, and then the rest of the sugya is going to focus around how do the poskim determine which of these interpretations should be relied upon under what circumstances. So let's first review what are the halachos that pertain to a pocheach. So the Mishnah continues and it says that a pocheach is allowed to be poris et shema. He's allowed, if he comes late to shul, so they used to have a custom, which we still have nowadays, is that a person who comes late, everyone's unwrapping their tefillin already, he gives a clap and he says, Melech Yachid, Kelchei Ha'olamim, Yisgadal V'Yisgadash, and he goes through the Kaddish and the Baruch Hu, and it used to be also that he would say the first bracha of Birchus Kriyat Shema out loud, and then he would lapse into silence for the remainder of Birchus Kriyat Shema. And hence, what this is called the Prisat Shema, like when you talk about being Poreis Al HaLechem, it means to break a bread in half. And so being pores et shema means to break the shema in half. He says half of it, half of the bracha was out loud, or some of the bracha was out loud, and some of the bracha was silently, and hence he's reciting the half shema, he's breaking the shema in half, and a person who's a pocheach is allowed to do that. Furthermore, he can be mitargein. In the olden days, there was a very, very beautiful custom that they had, that people did not understand Hebrew, and so when they read Kriyas HaTorah in Shul on Shabbos, after every Pasuk, there would be a translator who would translate that Pasuk into the vernacular, which was, at the time, Aramaic. And so, a pocheach is allowed to stand there. He would probably stand where one of the gabayim stand nowadays. I don't know whether he would stand in the gabay rishon spat or in the gabay sheni spat, but he would stand there, and after the Baal Kriya finished reading, he would translate each pasuk into Aramaic so that people could understand that, and a pocheach is allowed to fulfill that public function. He's allowed to stand up by the bima and translate the psukim. However, he's not allowed to be the Baal Kriya. He's not allowed to get an Aliyah, because back in the days of the Gemara, the people who got Aliyos would also be the ones to read the Torah. So a person who's a Pocheach is not allowed to get an Aliyah. Or he's also a no over lefnei teva. He's not allowed to go in front of the teva. Sometimes means the bima, and sometimes the teva means the aron. We have a different word for it. There's a big debate about which one it means at different times. Obviously, the aron nowadays, we understand why it's called a teva, because a teva just means a box, a receptacle, a container, and the aron most closely resembles a container. However, it's very probable that in the olden days, most bimos were made with a cabinet underneath them, and therefore, the top of the bima can also be described as the top of the teva. So to be yored lefnei ha-teva would mean to go down in front of either the bima, the amud, the aron, one of these things, and usually it's a reference when it appears in the Mishnah to being the chazan, the shliach tzibur for Shmona Esrei. So a pocheach is not allowed to get an aliyah, he's not allowed to be the shliach tzibur for Shmona Esrei, and a no noseat kapav, he's not allowed to do birkas kohanim, he's not allowed to duchan. Those are three things that a pocheach is not supposed to do.
Who determines?
That's what the next. Yeah. There's actually something which I did which was very, very unique on page 12. Usually I don't put my notes onto the source sheets, but in this case I did, and we'll get there hopefully at the end. So,
stay tuned.
Yeah. So, obviously, if you're looking at a Mishnah, you're looking at a page of Gemara, the first place that you're going to turn when you encounter an unfamiliar word is Rashi. And so, the next source to look at, first thing, is Rashi. And Rashi translates what a pocheach is, or at least what he believes a pocheach is, and he even brings some evidence. He apparently felt that this was not the type of assertion that he could make without backing it up, and therefore, in a somewhat unusual move for Rashi, Rashi actually quotes two pieces of evidence to back up his assertion about what the meaning of pocheach is. So Rashi says that pocheach, the Masechet Sofrim Mifarish, we explain in Masechet Sofrim, Kol Shekira'av Nir'in, anyone whose knees are visible. Kira'ayim are the knees, right? We find that in the Torah by grasshoppers, Asher lo kira'ayim imal l'raglav, l'nater bahin al'aretz, it's the thing that we use for jumping, and anyone whose knees are visible is a pocheach, and Rashi attributes this to Masechet Sofrim. Who here has heard of Masechet Sofrim? Okay, where will you find a Masechet Sofrim in a Shas? It's in the back of the volume that contains, very close, usually it's in the back, it probably depends on which version of the Shas you have, but in my version of the Shas, it's in the back of Masechet Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah comes with Avodah Zarah, and Horios, and then Idios, which is only Mishnayos. And in the back of that, at the end of Seder Nezikin, there are many Masechtos Ketanos, which include Masechet Sofrim and Avos de Rabbi Nasan and various other sets of Braisos that were not Mishnayos, but were composed by the Tanoim and preserved by the Yeshivos of Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshaya. And one of those sets of Braisos is Masechet Sofrim. So Rashi appeals to Masechet Sofrim and says that over there you'll discover that a pocheach is a person whose knees are visible. And then Rashi does something interesting, and he says, arom v'yachif. The words arom and yachif Mitargim, we translate them as artiloi upechach or picheach. So if you just match these up, if you assume it's an A-B-A-B rather than an A-B-B-A, which Rashi is clearly assuming because Arom means unclothed and Yachif means barefoot. So Artilai is parallel to Arom. That is the Aramaic translation of unclothed. Artilai is the Aramaic translation of unclothed. And Pachach should be the Aramaic translation of Yachif. And so you would expect, therefore, that whatever the Hebrew yachif evokes, barefoot, that is what pechach means as well.
Barefoot.
Barefoot. So there's already an anomaly here in Rashi. Right, let's, someone please perform this analysis for me. What's the difficulty with Rashi? Right, it's not clear from Rashi. Rashi first said Masechet Sofrim says it means knees uncovered, and then he seems to say from the Targum that it means barefoot. Okay, so we'll have to return to this. Maybe Rashi's saying it's a machlokes, what it means. Masechet Sofrim says one thing, and the Targum says something else. Or maybe Rashi's saying that this is two pieces of evidence, right, but only one of them is going to work. Or maybe Rashi says that we have to re-evaluate the way that we understand the word yachif, and maybe yachif also means barefoot up to the knee. All of these are possibilities. We're analyzing Rashi, and part of the job of analyzing a sugya and arriving at the psak halacha, perhaps one of the most difficult parts of the job, is keeping numerous possibilities in our heads all at once, and then each time that we encounter a new piece of evidence, to say, okay, does this piece of evidence eliminate any of the possibilities? Does it make any of the other possibilities more likely? But if we don't construct, if we don't make ourselves aware of the whole range of possibilities at the outset, then chances are that there's going to be something that we're missing. If we jump to any conclusion and just assume that Rashi means one thing, especially without basing that on any evidence, then we're very, very likely to miss some other possibility that will emerge later on and be more consistent with evidence that we encounter later. And so we have to keep in mind that there is what seems to be a contradiction in Rashi. There are two different definitions, and there may be a number of different ways to resolve that contradiction of definitions, and we'll have to see whether any later evidence bears out one or another of those ways.
What's the Targum says by Moshe when he met Kadosh Baruch Hu in the Sneh? He said, Shana lecha ma'alek lecha. Does it say Targum pachach was
there? Well, there it's all verbs, it's not nouns. So you would expect... You need another one? You would expect that there it'll be a verb. You know, take off your shoes from off your feet doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, make yourself barefoot.
So you think there's a between a noun and a verb?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we see two versions of the same word, one with a vav and one without the vav. So maybe that's the why one is talks about knees and one talks about no shoes.
Right. So maybe Rashi is saying that even though the word pechach is yachif, but that's only without the vav. With the vav, it might mean even more uncovered.
Or only the knees are uncovered.
Yeah, so for only
maybe
this,
there's no maybe there's no
contradiction.
Yeah.
No argument.
Okay, extra possibility. There's a second anomaly with Rashi as well, and that is that if we actually look up, as is important to do in general, when one has a leisure, and certainly when one is trying to arrive at a Lemaisa conclusion, we have to look up the primary sources that Rashi is quoting if we're able. And for that purpose, I have here the quote from Masechet Sofrim, as we have it, that Rashi appealed to when saying that a pocheach means a person whose knees are uncovered. So in source number 3, we have the full text of Masechet Sofrim that Rashi is quoting. It's in Perek Yodalid, and it says, pocheach hanir'in kara'av, which, again, if we're trying to translate as precisely as possible, means a pocheach whose knees are visible, o begadav perumim, right, or whose clothes are ripped, are torn, o mi sherosho migule, or one whose head is bare, is allowed to, and we'll get in a second to what he's allowed to do and what he's not allowed to do. But first, let me ask you, is there anything interesting about the syntax of this first group of three?
We're going to the head already.
We talk about the head.
We're talking about the knees first being uncovered, then we're talking about walking barefoot, and now we're going up to the head already.
Let me ask you a question. Is a person who's not wearing a yarmulke described by Masechet Sofrim as a pocheach?
I would think so, yeah. Rosh Migulah, no yarmulke.
Look very carefully at the syntax of the sentence. Pocheach hanirin kraav o begadav prumim o mi sherosho migule. What does the word mi mean?
Head is bare.
Anyone,
someone whose head is bare.
Bare, right.
So is that saying a pocheach whose head is bare, or is it a pocheach and someone whose head is bare? Just the grammar of the sentence. You can look at it in English also. I translated it very precisely. Pocheach, whose knees are visible, or whose toes are clothes are torn, or one whose head is bare.
That's not a pocheach.
It sounds like it's not a pocheach. Right. There's a pocheach. Okay, so that's point number one. A person who's not wearing a yarmulke is a separate category.
What about someone whose clothes are torn? According to the way you translated, that should be a separate category also.
No.
Look at the first one. Look at number two, the Rashi. It says just one whose knees are visible, naked and barefoot, is translated. That's the pokeach. But if you go and look at number three, it says whose knees are visible or whose clothes or whose head is bare. So why should that be different?
Right. Now let me just say it a little bit more precisely. You're totally on target in that observation. You would have expected it to say pocheach whose knees are visible, or one whose clothes are torn, or one whose head is bare. If a person whose clothes are torn is a separate category from pocheach, just like a person who's not wearing a yarmulke is a separate category, then it should have said a pocheach whose knees are visible, or one whose clothes are torn, mi shebegadav prumim, just like it says, o mi sherosho migule. So it sounds from the Masechet Sofrim that a person whose clothes are torn is equally described as a pocheach, right? Just like a person whose knees are bare is described as a pocheach.
Just before the part about the bare head, you have the word buck, which implies some kind of separation, like it's not the same thing.
We have an extra pronoun. That's exactly the key.
Yeah. You know the right word.
I'm a little bit. The one whose knees are uncovered, is it because they're torn or because he's wearing short pants? Which one is this?
See in a minute.
Because if it's short pants, then we're talking about erva. If it's not, if it's only torn knee caps or whatever, then there's no erva. Just that it's not nice to go to a shul with torn clothes.
If a person's not wearing pants at all, so then there's a problem of erva.
Okay. There's no question. I'm talking about, is it short pants or his knees are ripped?
Why if you rip off the bottom of the pants, or if the pants come with only half of them on, so why is there a difference in terms of erva between the two of them?
Long pants just has a hole by the knee.
Today it's a fashion to walk with your knees ripped. Mm-hmm. You rip the pants up, you know, the dungarees everywhere, you know. So it's a fashion today. Mm-hmm. It's a person allowed to walk up to the bima with those kind of pants.
Yeah.
It doesn't even say torn, so it's visible. So it could be a hole that's covered with something that's transparent.
It's passable as well. Indeed. Ah. Does anyone want to say that a pocheach is a fourth category? Could it be that there are four categories here? There's a pocheach, right, and one whose knees are visible, and one whose clothes are torn, and one whose head is bare?
No.
So we're pretty much unanimous in saying that a pocheach, according to Masechet Sofrim, means either someone whose knees are visible or someone whose clothes are torn. That seems to be the unanimous consent, right, of everyone here, that it means one of two things, and that both of them are described as a pocheach. If that's the case, so we have our second difficulty with Rashi. Having investigated Rashi's proof text at its source, we've discovered that it actually says much more than Rashi himself says. Rashi only quotes half of how Maseches Sofrim defines a pocheach, and what happened to the other half? Why did Rashi neglect it? Let's just finish the Maseches Sofrim, even though for our purposes we've seen most of what interests us. So this Maseches Sofrim says that a pocheach whose knees are visible or his clothes are torn, or one whose head is bare, may recite the half Shema. Some say that if his knees are visible or his garments are torn, he may recite the half Shema, but one whose head is bare may not recite Hashem's name. So a person who is Rosho Miguleh is a little bit different, which may explain why the Mishnah left out a person who's not wearing a yarmulke. Because the Mishnah had these five, it wanted to split it into a group of two and a group of three. And if it had talked about a person whose head is bare, it would have had to make a separate group. The Mishnah probably holds that a person not wearing a yarmulke is not allowed to say Hashem's name. But both may translate the Torah reading. Even a person whose head is bare is allowed to translate the Torah reading, but may not read the Torah or repeat the Shmon Esri for everyone, or recite Birkas Kohanim. So pretty much we understand that at least one whose knees are visible, or one whose clothes are torn, according to Maseches Sofrim, is allowed to say, to be Poreis al Shema. He's allowed to be Mitargeim, the Kriyas HaTorah, but he can't get an Aliyah, he can't be a Shliach Tzibur, and if he's a Kohen, he can't do Birkas Kohanim. Okay, that's anomaly number two in Rashi. Number one is that the definitions that Rashi quotes, one from Maseches Sofrim, the other from the Targum, contradict one another. Number two is that the definition that Rashi quotes from Maseches Sofrim seems to be only half of the definition that's offered in Maseches Sofrim itself. So what's the next step? Right, just following the pattern that we've begun to follow, what is the next source that we should look up? See if you can guess without looking at the next source on the sheet. But if you've looked, I'll forgive you. I'll let somebody tell me based on what the next source is. Right, the Targum that Rashi quotes, if we looked up the Maseches Sofrim to just verify and see maybe there's more evidence in Maseches Sofrim, because if we're gathering evidence, so we want to follow all the references to make sure that all the primary source material, that all of the earliest evidence is at our disposal. So if Rashi's quoting a Targum, then you would expect that we should look at the Targum. Right? Just like we looked at Maseches Sofrim, we should look at the Targum. These are the earliest pieces of evidence that shed light on what a pocheach means, and so we should take a look at them. So let's look at the English first, and then we'll turn back when we get to the relevant psukim, and we'll try to see what that can help us, how that can help us understand the meaning of a pocheach. So it says here, this again is from Machon Mamre's 1917 JPS translation of Tanakh. I don't vouch for it 100%, but let's see whether we like the translation or not. In the year that Tarsan Sartan came into Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Ashur, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and took it. At that time, Hashem spoke by Yeshaya the son of Amoz, saying, "Go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put thy shoe from off thy foot." And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. And Hashem said, "Just as my servant Yeshaya has walked naked and barefoot, to be for 3 years a sign and a wonder upon Egypt and upon Cush, so shall the king of Ashur lead away the captives of Egypt and the exiles of Cush, young and old, naked and barefoot, and chasufei sheit." I won't translate it out loud, but you can see what the translation is, at least according to GPS. "To the shame of Egypt, and they shall be dismayed and ashamed." I don't know if I like the dismayed. I would say that broken is a more accurate translation. "Because of Cush, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory." And the last pasuk is on the next page. And the inhabitant of this coastland shall say, island, coastland, behold, such is our expectation, whither we fled for help to be delivered from the king of Ashur, and how shall we now escape? So this is a prophecy that Yeshaya has about Mitzrayim and about Cush. And the prophecy contains, in three different places at least, references to the words Arom and Yachif, which is where Rashi is quoting from. Mitargim, Arom v'Yachif, Mitargim, Artilai u'Pichach. So first of all, let's just figure out. The nakedness that we're talking about is a result of what act of disrobing? God tells Yeshaya, loose the sackcloth from off thy loins. So we have to figure out for a second what exactly, just try to imagine, what is God asking Yeshaya to do? Was his sackcloth the only clothing that he was wearing, so that when he loosed the sackcloth from off his loins, he wasn't wearing anything? Was the sackcloth the equivalent of his shirt, so that when he loosed the sackcloth, he was still wearing pants, but he wasn't wearing a shirt? Was the sackcloth equivalent to pants, so that when he loosed the sackcloth, he wasn't wearing pants? Did he have underpants underneath it? And these are all questions that we have to know in order to know what it means, Arom, in this pasuk. What does Arom mean? Does it mean what we usually think of when we read the word Arom, or does it mean something else?
Equivalent to pants, but they didn't wear pants. It was like some kind of a sari from the belt and down.
Right, so the masnayim are the thighs, and if he's loosing something from off his thighs, it must mean that he's uncovered in the thigh area. So that much at least we can figure out, that the arom means to be uncovered in that area of the thighs at the very least, and presumably from the thighs downwards, because usually if something is on the thighs and you're unloosing it, it's going to reveal the area beneath it rather than the area above it. So it could be that he's still wearing a shirt, but not wearing anything below the shirt. That's what God told him to do as a sign, as an oath for what's going to happen to the shame of Egypt and the shame of Cush. Okay, what does Yachif mean? What did God instruct Yeshaya to do that left him being Yachif? That's pretty straightforward. Na'alcha tachalutz mi'al raglecha. Take your shoes off your feet. So we know now pretty much, we have a fairly good idea of how Yeshaya was dressed after he fulfilled the command of God, and at the time that he's described as being Haloch Arom v'Yachif. So let's see the Targum for a second. The Targum in Pasuk Beis, which is where Arom v'Yachif appears, it says, "Bidna hahi," at that time, "Gazar Hashem b'yad Yeshaya bar Amotz lememar," God decreed by Yeshaya the son of Amotz, saying, "Azel, go, v'teisar saka b'chartzeich." Hard to translate exactly what that means, but...
Remove the sack.
Tesar is from the word haser?
Yes.
And not from the word asir.
Exactly.
Okay, let's say, Tesar saka bichartzeich. Okay, the base is also a little bit anomalous. Right? Umisanach tishlof me'al raglach, and remove, withdraw the shoe from off your foot. Ve'avad kain, and he did so. Azal pachiach v'yachif. So let's just think for a second. If it's an A-B, so that means that Arom v'Yachif, Arom is the equivalent of Pachiach, and Yachif is the equivalent of Yachif. So it seems that our version of the Targum is different from Rashi's version of the Targum. Rashi had a different version of the Targum. Not sure whose version is Rashi's version, our version. I'm not sure which one. But our version has Pachiach, number one, with the Yod, and number two, that it has it as a translation of Arom rather than the translation of Yachif. You have it again in the next Pasuk, in Pasuk Gimel, Va'amar Hashem, Kima Dehalich Avdi Yeshayahu Pachiach V'Yachif. Now it's interesting that in our version of the Targum, Yachif is translated as Yachif. It's a little bit unusual. You would expect that it would be translated into Aramaic. So it's a little bit unusual, but the fact is that we have Yachif as Yachif and Arom as Pachiach. So that is something of note. It's anomaly number 3 in Rashi. Tosfos already point this out, as we'll see in a couple of pages. And this is anomaly number 3 in Rashi, in addition to the fact that his definitions contradict one another. In addition to his fact that his quote from Masechet Sofrim is only half of what Masechet Sofrim says, the third anomaly is that what he quotes from the Targum is not at all what the Targum says. Right? The Targum actually says, at least the way that we have it, that a pocheach is someone who's arom, and Rashi quotes it as being that a pocheach is someone who is yachif. Okay. If you're looking at a page of Gemara, we know that a standard page of Gemara radiates outwards from the center, with the Gemara being in the center, Rashi being on the inside of the page, Tosfos being on the outside of the page, and then on the far periphery of the page, there are a number of smaller commentaries. Rabbeinu Hananel is there, sometimes Tosfos Reed, Tosfos V'Azakein, which are from the Rishonim, and then there are little marginal notes from the Achronim. So you have very often the Hagahot Hagra, the Vilna Gaon's notes on the side of the Gemara. You have very often the Hagahot HaBach, the notes of the Bach on the side of the Gemara, and others. The way that these notes originated was that in the Gemaras of these Achronim, they would just make little notes in the margin, and the printers would, got their hands on the Shas of the Gra and on the Shas of the Bach, and they printed new Shas together with the marginal notes that were literally in the margins of the Gemaras that belonged to these Achronim. And these notes are usually very, very brief, because unlike nowadays when there's an abundance of paper, there was a tremendous shortage of paper in the olden days, and so the margins were very, very small, perhaps with the exception of Chasen Shasses. And so if you look in the margins, it was very, very small, even smaller than the margins of these pages, which are half an inch, I believe, much, much smaller, and so you could only fit a little bit of text into the margin. And it's interesting that this particular Hagos HaBach, it's very long, and he put it in the margin of his Gemara because he must have felt that it was quite important. And this is the Bach's analysis of Rashi. Now the Bach, if one is familiar with the Hagos HaBach, he usually does not engage in long analyses. The more the Bach is more like what we saw yesterday in the Hagos HaBach. He'll tell you that a certain word, perhaps he'll even just put dots on top of it to indicate that it should be that it should be deleted, that it didn't really belong in the Gemara to begin with. It didn't appear in the Gemara of Ravina and Rav Ashi. That doesn't even take up any marginal space. Just put some dots on top of the word. So for the Bach to make a long analysis in the margin of his Gemara is a very unusual phenomenon. Nonetheless, we have one over here. If you were to look in the margin at Av Meseches Megillah, Daf Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph, you would see an extraordinarily long Hagahos HaBach. And the Bach is going to address at least some of these anomalies that we've just noticed in Rashi. So the Bach says as follows. Rashi is trying to resolve the following difficulty. If Pocheach here means just barefoot, if it just means yachif, if the Targum is using the pocheach in the same way as the Mishnah is using pocheach, why may this pocheach not recite Birkas Kohanim? Did anyone notice this anomaly in Rashi? Why can't he say Birkas Kohanim? Don't all Kohanim have to remove their shoes before reciting that bracha? Every Kohen says Birkas Kohanim barefoot. So why is a person who's barefoot circumscribed from saying Birkas Kohanim? After all, he says, how do we know that the Kohanim used to say and still should say Birkas Kohanim barefoot? Bach doesn't want to let it go with nothing, so he says it's a Mishnah. Mishnah says, after all, Kohanim with disfigured feet may not recite Birkas Kohanim, lest people gaze at their feet, as Rashi himself explained later. So obviously Rashi is assuming that the contemporary practice of Kohanim going barefoot to do Birkas Kohanim was applicable in times of the Mishnah as well. In fact, Rashi seems to be assuming even more. Nowadays, Kohanim do Birkas Kohanim in their sacks. But apparently, in the times of the Mishnah, they wouldn't even be wearing sacks. That might be because they were wearing sandals, and so they weren't wearing sacks to begin with. Maybe it means that they took their sacks off before Birkas Kohanim, but the Mishnah says if he's got the disfigured feet, he should not do Birkas Kohanim because we're afraid that people will be staring at his feet and not concentrating on the bracha. And consequently, there is no way that a barefoot person can be forbidden from performing Birkas Kohanim. So that is out. That cannot be what Pocheach means. Therefore, Rashi cites the Masachas Sofrim that Pocheach is one whose knees are visible, i.e. one who's not wearing Batei Shokayim, right, which is a very cute Hebrew word. It means thigh houses, which is a way that the Gemara describes pants. Right? Hand houses are gloves, and foot houses are sacks, and thigh houses are pants. It's a very cute way that the Gemara has of describing different articles of clothing. They are things that house the body parts which they protect and keep private.
Is it Mishnayim?
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely correct. So what's the shok?
Right, but
yeah. So the if the masnayim are the thighs, what's the shok? The thighs. The masnayim are usually translated as the loins, which I think are. I never knew what the loins were exactly, but I assume that they're around the thighs. The shok. Usually,
you put your belt.
Right, so the shok then would be what? The shok would be the area between the thighs and the knees.
Between the knee, right. That's it by Yaakov Avinu. By Yaakov Malach by the shok ha'emin.
Right.
What is it? That's between the thigh and the knee.
Between the thighs and the knees. Okay. Yeah. Right. In Hilchos Tznius, right, that's always a big question. You know, shok miguleh. That is a big problem. So the question is, where exactly does a shok begin? Where exactly does a shok end? Right? But it seems that the Bach says that a person who's not wearing batei shokayim. Okay, so where is the shok?
Right. The shok is from Me'ar Tuva Velemata. That's really what the problem is. Because
Why? Because it's the Zecher Yaakov, no?
No.
No, doesn't have anything to do with it.
Nothing with it.
So the Bach says a person who's not wearing batei shokayim will have visible knees. He says those two are equivalent. If you're wearing batei shokayim, so then your knees will not be visible. If you're not wearing batei shokayim, well, actually, that's not necessarily perfect logic. If you're not wearing batei shokayim, then for sure your knees will be visible. But if you are wearing batei shokayim, could be your knees are visible also? No, your knees won't be visible, because then he's not going to say that because the knees are visible, the guy must not be wearing batei shokayim. It's got to be that if the knees are visible, the guy is not wearing batei shokayim. Yeah.
Talking about clothes, where the belt line is, like underneath the armpits, it says, then it goes down. And then imply that it's a kind of robe that might cover things underneath, including pants. So if he takes the pants off, he still has a robe covering him, maybe?
Could it be that a person is described as having visible knees even if he's wearing a robe? That it's, he needs to literally have something that's more, that's closer to his knees in order.
Partial robe from like the armpits, like the chest down.
You're already you're ahead of us already.
Oh, okay.
You're already reading the riff. I'm still in source number 5 here.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, it's wonderful. Precocious group. So Kadima.
I just want to tell you that in the Bereshit where it says that Adam and Chava were without clothes, the Onkelos writes of the Artilai.
Yeah.
That's
so what we saw by Artilai is the definite definition of absence of clothes.
Yeah, unless unless Yeshaya, and when God told Yeshaya, he had a little bit of Rachmanos, and he didn't want Yeshaya to be as arom as Adam was. And so the Targum may have had a tradition that the aromness of Yeshaya wasn't full artilai, but maybe it was something a little bit less than artilai. So it's interesting, we have to know, what if a person's wearing a robe? What if a person's wearing transparent pants? What if a person is wearing knee-high socks that cover his knees, but he's not wearing batei shokayim? So these are all questions, but what seems, again, Rashi says knees are visible, and now the Bach is translating that as a person who's not wearing batei shokayim, he's not wearing clothing that encase and that house his knees. His legs between the thigh and the knee. Now the Bach brings an additional proof. He says this is also why Rashi explained later that being a pocheach involves a possible violation of lo yireh b'cha ervat davar. Somebody mentioned this earlier. I think you mentioned this earlier, that there's a possible violation of lo yireh b'cha ervat davar. I say possible with a strong emphasis on possible, not definite. We'll see why in the next source. But there's a possible violation of seeing an ervat davar, seeing a part of the body that ought to remain private out of a sense of shame, that it ought to remain private. Since this person who's a pocheach is not wearing pants at all, so there's a prohibition if a person is davening, when that person is leading the services, there's a prohibition of seeing uncovered body parts. But if one took off his shoes while still wearing pants, even though he's barefoot, there's no concern of seeing uncovered body parts. And therefore there would be no question about lo yireh b'cha ervat davar. So the Bach, what it seems that he's done is, he's taken these two pieces of evidence that Rashi quoted, and he said that Rashi is quoting the translation of the Targum in order to reject it, and he's quoting the translation of Maseches Sofrim in order to accept it. And in order to prove why the Targum is rejected, right, what is it that causes us to give greater weight to the Targum's version of Pocheach to the Maseches Sofrim's version of Pocheach over that of the Targum? So the Bach quotes, he says, first of all, Bam Kasha, that there's no way that a person who's Yachif can be prohibited from performing Birkas Kohanim. And then he says, second of all, we have the fact that the Gemara, as we'll see in a moment, assumed that a Pocheach has his erva exposed. And there's no way at all that that has anything to do with having his shoes off, but it may have something more to do with having his knees uncovered, because at least if the knees are uncovered, you can at least assume that maybe it's because he's not wearing pants, which would lead us to suspect that the erva is revealed as well. So these are two pieces of evidence that the Bach quotes that causes us to give greater weight to the Maseches Sofrim and less weight to the Targum. Do either of these pieces of evidence help us explain the other anomaly in Rashi? Meaning the Bach explained two. He explained the contradiction. Rashi's proof telling us one we reject, the other we accept. He didn't really explain why our Targum is different from Rashi's Targum, but at least he explained why it is that Rashi quotes these two differing definitions. Anything that the Bach said help us resolve any of the other anomalies in Rashi? Does it help us explain why Rashi only quoted half of Maseches Sofrim?
Two-thirds of the Orthodox Jews in Israel between the 1940s and to today, that has a dominant short, because that's how things are done for the most part in Israel nowadays. They're improper.
Okay, so let me emphasize one thing. Right? The Mishnah is discussing five different things. It's discussing Horeis al Shema, which is okay, and Mitar Gain, which is okay, getting an Aliyah, which is not, being the Shliach Tzibur, which is not, and doing Birkas Kohanim, which is not. To daven, Mishnah doesn't talk at all. Mishnah is not talking here about davening in shorts at all. It seems like it goes without saying. Right? It goes without saying that a person, right, who's wearing shorts can daven his own private tefillah. Whether that's ideal or whether that's not ideal, we may encounter one or two sources later on in this packet that talk about whether it's ideal or whether it's not ideal, but there certainly is no prohibition against davening in shorts. The only question is, can a person get an aliyah? Can he be a bal kriya? Can he be a shliach tzibur? Can he do birkas kohanim? We may discover why that is also towards the end of this year. Right, so far, just keep in mind that all that we've seen, if you're on a page of Gemara, is the Gemara, and then we just turned to Rashi. We looked up Rashi's two sources, then we saw the Bach who commented on Rashi. We haven't even read Tosfos yet. We haven't even read Tosfos. So we don't have a full picture, but what we can say that definitively is that it would seem that if a Kohen in Eretz Yisrael says Birkas Kohanim in shorts, Rashi would disapprove of him. You know, there's a cute story that there was a big Talmud Chacham, I don't know who the story is about, but there was a big Talmud Chacham, and you know, he learned, and one time he thought that he came up with an answer to Akasha of Rabbeinu Tam, a really, really vexing question of Rabbeinu Tam, and he was really, really happy. And that night, Rabbeinu Tam appeared to him in a dream. And he came to him in a dream, and he was so happy. He said, Rabbeinu Tam, I've answered your kasha. And Rabbeinu Tam looked at him and says, you're not even wearing kosher tefillin. Right? How can you be so happy about answering my kasha? You know, so...
He's holding with his grandfather.
Right, okay, so you also have to deal with the Arizal, you know, who said that the Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam would not actually disagree about the tefillin. But the fact is that, you know, just Rashi might hold that this is inappropriate, or Rashi might hold that the Mishnah says that this is inappropriate, right? But the Mishnah, according to Rashi, is not necessarily how we paskin. It could be that there's going to be an overwhelming amount of evidence, either that that this Mishnah reflects the opinion of an individual, or there might be an overwhelming amount of evidence that the true interpretation of the Mishnah is not Rashi's interpretation. So we have to keep in mind that so far, in spite of the amount of time that we've devoted to it, this is only Rashi's interpretation of the Mishnah. We'll have to see whether there are other, perhaps stronger interpretations of the Mishnah. But we definitely could say that having only seen Rashi, that the contemporary practice in Eretz Yisrael seems to be against what Rashi would approve of. Okay.
In general, nowadays you have the have tens of thousands of kids in like Orthodox Jewish camps, including the council was in staff that went around a short entire day, because that's a common acceptable way of,
because you would have thought that maybe playing baseball should be more similar to to getting an aliyah than it is to being Horeis al Shema. And so perhaps we can learn in this Mishnah that the person shouldn't play baseball in shorts, they should put on long pants before they play baseball.
That's all the facts, though. That the daven 3 times a day in shorts, that's a way of life.
Okay, we'll get there. We'll get there. This is again, when I said my high school students, this Mishnah was a particularly interesting Mishnah for them, because you know they looked at the Mishnah and they looked at Rashi and they said, that explains why, the camps that we go to don't let us wear shorts for davening. Or they said, I don't understand, why the camps let us wear shorts for davening. It depends on which camp they went to. And part of what I tried to impress upon them, right, is that if you only see the Mishnah in Rashi, you'll come away with that impression. Right? And if you don't look carefully at the Mishnah, which is talking about being a shliach tzibur, you'll come away with that impression. But if you understand that the Mishnah is not talking about a person's personal davening, that doesn't mean it's right. No, it doesn't mean it's the best thing. No, but it's not what the Mishnah is talking about. The Mishnah is not talking about playing baseball in shorts. It's not even talking about davening one's personal tefillah in shorts. It's only talking about being a shliach tzibur or getting an aliyah, being a balkriya or doing birkas kohanim in shorts. So we can say that the kohanim who do birkas kohanim in shorts, right, in Eretz Yisrael, where they do birkas kohanim on a daily basis, Rashi would seem to disapprove of them, right, and that's the only conclusion that we can draw at present. The Mishnah is not dealing with personal davening, right, and the Mishnah, we have to see whether other Rishonim think that the Mishnah is dealing with shorts. All we can say is Rashi being a shliach tzibur. Fine. So let's look at source number 6 for a second, which I think will the Bach quoted source number 6, and I think that may help us resolve at least one of the other anomalies in Rashi. The Gemara says, Ba'a minei ula bar rav me Abaye. Ula asked the following question from Abaye. Katan pocheach mahu sheyikra batorah. I know the Mishnah says that an adult who's a pocheach is not allowed to read the Torah, he's not allowed to get an aliyah. But in the times of the Gemara, before the custom originated not to give aliyos to children and not to have children be bali kriya, so the question is, before that custom originated, perhaps only an adult who is wearing shorts can't be a bali kriya and can't get an aliyah, but maybe a child who's under bar mitzvah, if he's wearing, well, I shouldn't say wearing shorts, if he's a pocheach, perhaps he could read the Torah and he could get an aliyah. What's the difference between an adult and a child? Why should we differentiate between an adult who's a pocheach and a child who's a pocheach? So here, Rashi in source number 7 tells us, and he explains the hava amina of the Gemara. The Gemara thought that maybe there's a chance that there's a difference between an adult and a child, and Rashi says, perhaps an adult pocheach is forbidden on account of lo yir'e b'cha ervat davar, that the private parts of an adult, right, which are capable of generating zera, which can produce children, those are considered to be a makom erva, and therefore nobody should daven in front of the tzibur with that is revealed, because it's a violation of lo yir'e b'cha ervat davar. In contrast, the private parts of a child, which the Gemara believes are incapable of producing viable zera that can result in conception of a child, so therefore that's not considered a full makom erva, or you could say it a little bit differently, an adult, right, already has a natural sense of shame and a child doesn't. One way or another, the fact is that the makom erva of a child is not considered to be an erva halachically, and that Rashi says is what informs the distinction in the hava amina of the Gemara between an adult who might be, right, who is forbidden, and a child who might be permitted. Or, says Rashi, perhaps the Mishnah does not differentiate between a child and an adult. So, this doesn't require any independent analysis. What did the Bach do with this Gemara? How did the Bach understand this Havamina? What was the critical point that the Bach derived from this possible distinction between an adult and a child? Not only is it not barefoot, but what is it?
Knees.
The knees? From the Gemara?
No.
Knees are not a makom erva. Nobody thinks that the knees are a makom erva. The Gemara seems to be thinking, it seems to be understanding, or at least entertaining the possibility, that a pocheach is a person who's not wearing any pants or underpants at all. Otherwise, there is no giloi makom erva. The Gemara seems to be entertaining the possibility that a pocheach is a person who is not wearing any clothing from the waist downwards, which is a really weird possibility. It's really, really strange. Right? That's what a pocheach is. Not a person whose feet are uncovered, not a person whose knees are uncovered, but a person whose waist is uncovered. It's astonishing. It's mamish astonishing. It's a havamina. Right? It's a half amina, so it's very likely that it's rejected in the maskana. But sometimes there's extra weight that we give to half aminas. Sometimes if the Gemara assumes something in a half amina and doesn't give us reason to reverse that assumption in the Maskana, so we'll sometimes accept the assumption of the Hava Amina and assume that what changes between the Hava Amina and the Maskana is only on the narrowest of scales. So what is the Gemara's Maskana? The Gemara says, Amar Lei, right, Taima, right, Arom my Taima Lo, why is a person who is Arom, right, not allowed to be a Shliach Tzibur, Mishum Kivod Tzibur, right, because it's it affronts the public's dignity, it's not Kavod at Tzibur. So too, even when a child, who there's no formal problem of lo yireh b'chayr vas davar, if he's not wearing any clothing, but there remains a problem of kavod tzibur. Do I have another 2 minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the Gemara has now decided, and this is the authoritative conclusion of the Gemara, that the reason that a pocheach cannot be a shliach tzibur, a bal kriya, cannot get an aliyah or do birkas kohanim, is because it's an affront to the dignity of the public. That's something that we need to file away in the back of our mind. Not only do we have a halacha, we also have the Gemara provides the reason behind the halacha, that it's mishum kavod tzibur. There's something else which is also critical to derive from this Gemara, and that is that the Gemara is drawing a distinction between a pocheach and an arom. Right? It says, what about a child who's a pocheach? Can he read the Torah? Can he be a shliach tzibur? Right? Why did you ask me about a child pocheach? Ask me about a child who is arom. So arom is different from pocheach. Now, what is the difference? I'm not sure. Arom maybe means also not wearing a shirt. Pocheach means only not wearing pants. Right? Or is it that pocheach means that his knees are uncovered, but we know it can mean a person whose knees are uncovered, because then what's the issue by an adult of lo yireh b'chayr vas davar? What's the distinction? So it would seem that an arom would mean a person who's totally uncovered, as opposed to a pocheach, which means a person who's still wearing a shirt, but is uncovered, right, from the waist down. And the Bach says, aha, so now we have a new anomaly with Rashi, a new anomaly. Now, the Bach definitely succeeded in proving from this Gemara that a person who is, right, that a pocheach does not mean a person whose feet are uncovered alone. But at the same time, the Gemara poses a challenge, because Rashi says that a pocheach means a person whose knees are uncovered, and the Gemara seems to indicate that it's not just the knees which is uncovered, but it's the entire waistline which is uncovered. So maybe Rashi was just being tzniustik, he didn't want to say that a pocheach, but there's halacha involved over here. If a pocheach means a person who's uncovered the waist down, then perhaps a person who's covered up until the knees, right, is still going to be allowed to be a shliach tzibur, and will still be permitted to be a bal kriya or to get an aliyah or do birkas kohanim. So even though on the one hand, right, the Bach did provide some evidence for rejecting the targum, right, which says simply barefoot, at the same time, he has also provided us with a fourth anomaly in Rashi that we had not encountered before, and that is that Rashi seems to be at odds with the Gemara. The Gemara seems to be assuming that a pocheach means a person who's uncovered from the waist down, whereas Rashi seems to be saying that even if he's covered from the waist until the knees, if he's uncovered from the knees down, so he still is disqualified from filling these public roles. Now, it is true that the Gemara had a Hava Amina and a Maskana. So the simplest thing, but certainly not the only thing to do, would be to say that when the Gemara concluded that the issue is an issue of Kavod HaTzibur, so it meant to say that for sure a person who's uncovered from the waist down is a problem of Kavod HaTzibur. However, even a person who's uncovered from the knees down would still be a problem of Kavod HaTzibur. But, again, that's not explicit in the Gemara. Right? It's not explicit in the Gemara, because maybe a person whose knees are uncovered is still covered at Tzibur. Maybe a person who's wearing shirts that end before the knees, the Gemara doesn't talk about the knees. It's a Maseches Sofrim that talks about the knees. So what the Gemara proves is that it's barefoot alone, right, is not enough. Right? But the Gemara also tells you in the Hava Amina that the knees alone is also not enough. The Maskana, right, maybe, which tells you that we're talking about an issue of covered at Tzibur, So we know for sure that a person who's uncovered from the waist down is a violation of Kavarat Tzibur, but in terms of being uncovered from the knees down, or maybe even just having the feet uncovered, the Maskanas HaGemara doesn't really prove for us whether the Targum is more correct than the Maseches Sofrim, because if you're assuming the Maskanas HaGemara is against the Hava Amina of the Gemara, so then just like the Maskanas HaGemara maybe will entertain that uncovered knees are a violation of Kavarat Tzibur, maybe it will also entertain that uncovered feet are a violation of Kavarat Tzibur. So if the Bach is appealing to the Hava Amina, creates a fourth anomaly with Rashi. In order to resolve that anomaly with Rashi, so you're going to have to jettison the possibility of using this piece of the Gemara as proof. So we'll start off tomorrow, Be'ezras Hashem, we'll just recap where exactly we're holding with Rashi's opinion, and then we'll move on, Be'ezras Hashem, to the opinion of other Rishonim, which might indicate that there's less of a problem with shorts and more of a problem with some other mode of dress, which can also be described as pocheach.